Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 448, the coup attempt of 1934, being recorded on March 7th of 2004. The following program is excerpted from RFA program number 10, recorded on July 11th of 1985, and it concerns a 1934 coup attempt by some of the same industrialists and financiers that had backed Hitler, Mussolini, and the fascist Japanese. They attempted to overthrow Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, that is, because of their extreme displeasure with the New Deal. Again, this is from RFA 10, recorded on July 11th, 1985. In addition to my own voice, you will hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Now, we're going to be reading several segments here from a book entitled Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. And this book is copyright 1983 from Dell. This is a paperback edition. Now, also bear in mind that Charles Higham has written another rather good book that's just come out called American Swastika, which is in hardcover at this point. It is not out in softcover, I don't believe yet, but is another fascinating book on this general vein, and both of them come highly recommended from Dave and myself. Okay, now, again, though, from trading with the enemy back to the subject of industrial cooperation with fascism, and in fact, downright industrial support for fascism in many cases. Reading from Higham's book. General Motors, under the control of the DuPont family of Delaware, played a part in collaboration comparable with Ford's General Aniline, General Aniline and Film had heavy investments in the company. Irene DuPont was the most imposing and powerful member of the clan. He was obsessed with Hitler's principles. He keenly followed the career of the future Führer in the 1920s, and on September 7, 1926, in a speech to the American Chemical Society, he advocated a race of supermen to be achieved by injecting special drugs into them in boyhood to make their characters to order. He insisted his men reach physical standards equivalent to that of a marine and have blood as pure as that in the veins of the Vikings. Despite the fact that he had Jewish blood in his own veins, his anti-Semitism matched that of Hitler.
Interrupting the text, remember that's 1926, folks, from Irene DuPont, the founder, or the main person in the DuPont family, one of the dominant families, but 1926...
Okay, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. IG Farben, for those of you who are not familiar, was the huge German chemical cartel that originally began as a combination of the dyestuffs, the various dyestuffs manufacturers in Germany, and because around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, so much of the chemical industry was concerned with dyestuffs and their various byproducts and usages. Eventually, their control of that market led IG Farben to become one of the biggest and most important commercial chemical manufacturers in the entire world, and by far the most important in Germany and in Europe.
Also, IG Farben's throwing of its support to Hitler is generally regarded as one of the decisive factors in assuring his rise to power.
All right. Again, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. On several visits with Hermann Schmitz and Karl Krauch of Farben in Berlin in 1933, Wendell R. Swint, S-W-I-N-T, DuPont's foreign relations director, discovered that IG and the gigantic Krupp industrial empire had arranged for all Nazi industry to contribute 0.5% of its entire wage and salary roll to the Nazis, even before they rose to power. Thus, Swint, who testified to this effect at the 1934 munitions hearings, admitted under oath that DuPont was fully aware it was financing the Nazi Party through 0.5% of its Opel wages and salaries, as well as through its deals with IG and its building of armored cars and trucks. Simultaneously with the rise of Hitler, the DuPonts in 1933 began financing native fascist groups in America, including the anti-Semitic and anti-black American Liberty League and the organization known as Clark's Crusaders, which had 1,250,000 members in 1933. Pierre, Irene, and Lamotte DuPont, and John Jacob Raskob funded the Liberty League along with Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors. The League smeared Roosevelt as a communist, claimed the president was surrounded by Jews, and, despite the fact that they were Jewish, the DuPonts smeared Semitic organizations. The connections between General Motors and the Nazi government began at the moment of Hitler's rise to power. Goering declined to annex General Motors, and indeed received with pleasure William S. Knudsen, General Motors president, who returned on October 6, 1933 to New York, telling reporters that Germany was, quote, the miracle of the 20th century.
Early in 1934, Irénée DuPont and Knudsen reached their explosion point over President Roosevelt. Along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, recall that the Morgan Financial Group includes DuPont Chemicals, Morgan Bank, and General Motors, beginning again, along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, certain DuPont backers financed a coup d'etat that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. Who was to be the figurehead for this ill-advised scheme, which would result in Roosevelt being forced to take orders from businessmen as part of a fascist government, or face the alternative of imprisonment and execution? DuPont men allegedly held an urgent series of meetings with the Morgans. They finally settled on one of the most popular soldiers in America, General Smedley Butler of Pennsylvania. Butler, a brave hero, had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and his brilliant career as Commandant of the Marine Corps had made him a legend. He would, the conspiratorial group felt, make an ideal replacement for Roosevelt if the latter proved difficult. These business chiefs found great support for their plan in Hermann Schmitz, Baron von Schroeder, and the other German members of the fraternity. Interrupting here, the fraternity is a name that Charles Higham has applied to this cozy group of German and American industrialists and financiers who formed what I guess, for lack of a better term, we could call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that essentially was the focus of our Uncle Sam in the broadcast and which we're looking at in part tonight. So that's what Higham means here by the fraternity. Continuing, the backers of the bizarre conspiracy selected a smooth attorney, Gerald McGuire, to bring word of the plan to General Butler. McGuire agreed Butler would be the perfect choice. Butler had attacked the New Deal in public speeches. McGuire met with Butler at the latter's house in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, and in a hotel suite nearby. With great intensity, the fascist attorney delivered the scheme to the general. Butler was horrified. Although there were many things about Roosevelt he disliked, a coup d'etat amounted to treason, and Butler was nothing if not loyal to the Constitution. However, he disclosed nothing of his feelings. With masterful composure, he pretended interest and waited to hear more. When McGuire returned, it was with news of more millions and more extravagant plans, which included turning America into a dictatorship with Butler as a kind of Hitler. Once more, Butler was infuriated but kept quiet. After McGuire left on the second occasion, the general got in touch with the White House. He told Roosevelt of the entire plan. Roosevelt's state of mind can scarcely be imagined. He knew that in view of the backing from high banking sources, this matter could not be dismissed as some crackpot enterprise that had no chance of success. He was well aware of the powerful forces of fascism that could easily make America an ally of Nazism, even that early, only 1 year after Hitler had risen to power. On the other hand, Roosevelt also knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States. That's worth mentioning here, worth remembering here, that Roosevelt was quite aware that he was not the most powerful man in the country. John Kennedy found that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the plan had to be deactivated immediately. The answer was to leak it to the press. The newspaper ran the story of the attempted coup on the front page, but generally ridiculed it as absurd and preposterous. When Thomas Lamont of the Morgan Bank arrived from Europe by steamer, he was asked by a crowd of reporters to comment. "Perfect moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon," unquote, was the reply. Roosevelt couldn't quite let the matter rest. Under pressure from liberal Democrats, he set up a special House committee to investigate. Butler begged the committee to summon the DuPonts, but the committee declined, nor would it consent to call anyone from the House of Morgan. Then Butler dropped a bombshell. He gave interviews to the press announcing that none other than General Douglas MacArthur was a party to the plot. This, again, was dismissed by the press, and MacArthur laughed it off. Interrupting here, MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. That's one of the reasons this was such a bombshell. Before Niptuck continues here, note here that we have some of the most powerful financiers and industrialists in America financing a proposed military coup d'etat. This is a matter of public record, although the record has been obscured. It's worth underscoring the point here, because most Americans don't really think of the United States as a place where a military coup might take place, and our point is that this has been attempted in the past.
The committee hearings were a farce. McGuire was allowed to get away with saying that Butler had, quote, misunderstood his intentions. Other witnesses lamely made excuses, and there the matter rested. It was 4 years before the committee dared to publish its report in a white paper that was marked for, quote, restricted circulation. They were forced to admit that, quote, certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. The committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, unquote. This admission that the entire plan was deadly in intent was not accompanied by the imprisonment of anybody. Further investigations disclosed that over 1 million people had been guaranteed to join the scheme, and that the arms and munitions necessary would have been supplied by Remington, a DuPont subsidiary. The DuPont's fascistic behavior was seen in 1936. When Irene DuPont used General Motors' money to finance the notorious Black Legion. This terrorist organization had as its purpose the prevention of automobile workers from unionizing. The members wore hoods and black robes with skull and crossbones. They firebombed union meetings, murdered union organizers, often by beating them to death, and dedicated their lives to destroying Jews and communists. They linked to the Ku Klux Klan. Irene DuPont encouraged General Motors' foreman to join the Legion. In one episode, a Detroit worker, Charles Poole, was brutally murdered by a gang of Black Legionists, several of whom belonged to the sinister Wolverine Republican League of Detroit. This organization had as its members several in big business. However, their names were kept out of the papers during the Poole case trial. It was brought out at the last that at least 50 people, many of them blacks, had been butchered by the Legion, which swept through General Motors factories and had 75,000 members. At the same time, the DuPonts developed the American Liberty League, a Nazi organization whipping up hatred of blacks and Jews, love of Hitler, and loathing of the Roosevelts. Financed by Lameau and Irene to the tune of close to $500,000 the first year, the Liberty League had a lavish 31-room office in New York, branches in 26 colleges, and 15 subsidiary organizations nationwide that distributed 50 million copies of its Nazi pamphlets. In September 1936, while Hitler at Nuremberg expressed his grand design for the four-year plan, the DuPonts and the American Liberty League poured thousands into backing Republican Alf Landon against Roosevelt in that election. Other backers were the American Nazi Party and the German-American Bund.
Okay, now, again, before continuing with this, not only have the DuPonts and the Morgan Group attempted a coup in this country, their exposure in attempting to do that didn't back them off one bit. They proceeded to plunge wholeheartedly into the financing of American domestic American fascism. Continuing here, the attempt to launch Landon failed, which made the DuPonts hate Roosevelt even more. In outright defiance of Roosevelt's desire to improve working conditions for the average man, Knudsen of General Motors, along with the DuPonts, instituted the speed-up systems created by another prominent figure of the fraternity, Charles Bedeau, B-E-D-A-U-X. These forced men to work at terrifying speeds on the assembly lines. Many died of the heat and the pressure, increased by fear of losing their jobs at a time when there were very few available. Irene personally paid almost $1 million from his own pocket for armed and gas-equipped stormtroops modeled on the Gestapo to sweep through the plants and beat up anyone who proved rebellious. He hired the Pinkerton Agency to send its swarms of detectives through the whole chemicals, munitions, and automobile empire to spy on left-wingers or other malcontents. By the mid-1930s, General Motors was committed to full-scale production of trucks, armored cars, and tanks in Nazi Germany. By the way, that's the mid-1930s. Continuing, the GM board could be guaranteed to preserve political, personal, and commercial links to Hitler. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, who was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Let me read that last sentence again. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Others present, delivering equally Hitlerian addresses, were Governor Eugene D. Talmadge of Georgia, his son became a senator from that state, by the way, and the Nazi Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith. Remember the name Gerald L. K. Smith, we'll come back to him. Sloan frequently visited Berlin, where he hobnobbed with Goering and Hitler. Graham K. Howard was a vice president of General Motors. Under FBI surveillance throughout his whole career with the company, he was an outright fascist who wrote a poisonous book, America and a New World Order, that peddled the line of appeasement and a virtually identical doctrine to that of Hitler in terms of free trade and the restoration of the gold standard for the United States of fascism, in which General Motors would no doubt play a prominent part. Note that he refers to the United States of fascism here.
Yes, and bear in mind, this is the same General Motors they're talking about, of whom one of their presidents, one of GM's presidents, once said, "What's good for GM is good for America." Reading on, another frequent visitor to Germany was the rugged, cheerful, hearty James D. Mooney, head of the European end of the business, directly in charge of the Atom Opel production. On December 22, 1936, in Vienna, Mooney told U.S. diplomat George Messerschmitt, who, despite his German family origin, hated Hitler, quote, "We ought to make some arrangements with Germany for the future. There is no reason why we should let our moral indignation over what happens in that country stand in the way." In other words, although the mass of Americans despised the Nazis, business must continue as usual. Messerschmitt was furious. He snapped back, "We can hardly be expected to trade with a country only so that it can get those articles which it intends to use against the peace of the world." Unquote. In a report of December 23rd to the acting Secretary of State in Washington, Messerschmitt wrote, quote, "It is curious that Mooney and Colonel Sosthenes Bain, B-E-H-N, both give this opinion. The factories owned by IT&T in Germany are running full-time and in double shifts, and increasing their capacity for the simple reason that they are working almost entirely on government orders and for military equipment. The Opel Works, owned by General Motors, are also working very well in the same way." That Christmas, Mooney was in Berlin for talks with Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht to discuss Germany's and America's joint future in the world of commerce. He attracted the hatred of the liberal U.S. ambassador to Germany, William E. Dodd, who returned from Berlin to New York in 1937, and referred to the Fraternity, again, the author Haim's name for this grouping of industrialists, who referred to the Fraternity in a shipboard press conference in New York Harbor. Dodd was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government, and is working closely with the fascist regimes in Germany and Italy. I have had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. On the ship, a fellow passenger, who is a prominent executive of one of the largest financial corporations, told me point blank that he would be ready to take definite action to bring fascism into America if President Roosevelt continued his progressive policies." Unquote. Okay, now, again, we've talked, it may seem like we've branched off slightly in talking about participation of DuPont and GM with Nazi Germany and the Nazi war machine in Europe, but if you'll remember also, we started out talking about people like Wesley Swift and Richard Butler in Aryan Nations and William Potter Gale in Identity, and we mentioned the fact that William Potter Gale was on the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. We also mentioned that the GM and DuPont people tried to finance a coup d'etat attempt to take over the White House and either imprison or execute Franklin Roosevelt, and they approached Major General Smedley D. Butler to be essentially the American Hitler and lead the military to perform this coup. Now, these two trails, William Potter Gale and his later building up of the Identity Movement and the Morgan GM DuPont-sponsored coup attempt are going to start tying together.
Okay, now, remember that General Douglas MacArthur was reportedly involved in this plot to overthrow the government of the United States. Again, this was going to be a simple military coup. Now, Smedley Butler, who was the fellow who was picked to lead that plot, testified that MacArthur was involved with the plotters, although he did testify at one point that he wasn't sure if MacArthur was aware of the plans. Still, in many other times when he gave testimony, he implicated MacArthur directly in the plot. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at are some of MacArthur's connections. But again, remember Douglas MacArthur's role with as basically the one of the proposed agents of the DuPont Rockefeller, or the DuPont Morgan Financial Group here, okay, because that's an industrial group. That is essentially why we went into that particular group, to show that one of the most powerful alliances of financiers and industrialists in this country was openly pro-Hitler, as we've talked about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that moreover they were willing to overthrow the democratic government of the United States and were very active in funding domestic fascism. Still more about the attempted coup in 1934. This is from a book called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer. It's copyrighted in 1973 by Hawthorne Books. The interview here is between Jules Archer and former Speaker of the House John McCormick, who was co-chairman of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, the House committee set up to investigate the coup. Archer's interrogation or questioning of McCormick goes as follows. I asked McCormick what his own reactions had been to McGuire's testimony denying all of Butler's allegations. There was no doubt that General Butler was telling the truth, he replied. We believed his testimony 100%. He was a great, patriotic American in every respect. Skipping down, Jules Archer asks, had the plotters only wanted to take over the White House to restore the gold standard, or were they also out to destroy the New Deal and set up a fascist dictatorship to run the country through an American Mussolini? McCormick reflected a moment, then said, well, we were in the depths of a severe recession, and we had a good man, Roosevelt, in the White House, and he'd revived the hopes and confidence of the American people. The plotters definitely hated the New Deal because it was for the people, not for the moneyed interests, and they were willing to spend a lot of their money to dump Mr. Roosevelt out of the White House. Could you say definitely that the American Liberty League was the organization of big fellows that McGuire had described as being behind the plotters? I don't know anything about the Liberty League, he replied in a crisp manner that did not encourage me to pursue any further interrogation along that line. Mr. Speaker, why were the plotters so insistent that General Butler accept their proposal that he be the one to head the fascist march on Washington they planned? They chose Smedley Butler because they needed an enlisted man's general, not a general's general, unquote. They had to have a colorful figure, a half a million or more veterans who had been privates and non-coms would follow. General Butler was the most popular one. If General Butler had been an ambitious man like Aaron Burr and had been willing to be the man on the white horse for the plotters, do you think their conspiracy to take over the White House with all that money behind it might have succeeded? Well, if General Butler had not been the patriot he was, and if they'd been able to maintain secrecy, the plot certainly might very well have succeeded, having in mind the conditions existing at that time. Remember interrupting here that he says, basically, if Butler hadn't been of the orientation that he was, and if they had maintained secrecy, the plot would have succeeded. We're going to examine events that happened later and ask the question, did they succeed at a later date? Continuing, No one can say for sure, of course, but when times are desperate and people are frustrated, anything like that could happen. And we might have gone fascist? If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. They wouldn't have told the people what they were doing, of course. They were going to make it all sound constitutional, of course, with a high-sounding name for the dictator, and a plan to make it all sound like a good American program. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. He failed with his beer hall putsch, but he succeeded when he was better organized. The same thing could have happened here. So, again, that this, despite the denials from the people who were involved, there was a very, very real attempt at a fascist coup in the United States in 1934, backed by some of the most powerful and most prominent members of American society, whose firms, whose the industrial and financial firms that they worked through, dominate the United States today. Firms like General Motors, DuPont, the Morgan Bank, and so forth. Of course, we've looked at that in connection with the funding of Nazi Germany. The point is that this same group was ready, willing, and able to establish fascism in the United States.
Okay, from a little further on in the plot to seize the White House, this is a transcription of, I can't think of the term right now, but basically it's a literalization of the testimony of Major General Smedley D. Butler when he was talking about his conversations with Gerald McGuire, this attorney who contacted Butler on behalf of the, quote, fraternity, as author Charles Higham had had it in the other book. Anyway, So this is not the translation, which we have too, but this is just the authors putting this into expository form. But that's the butler that he's referring to is Major General Smedley D. Butler, who at this point is leading the attorney, Gerald McGuire, on about what this organization can do and will do. There was only one Morgan in the financial world. The attorney has just referred to backing from Morgan, J.P. Morgan and Company. McGuire left no doubt in his mind, Butler's mind that is, that the nation's biggest financiers were indeed involved. According to the bond salesman, there had been a meeting in Paris to decide upon the selection of the man to head the superorganization. McGuire and his group had held out for Butler, but the Morgan interests distrusted the general as, quote, too radical, preferring Douglas MacArthur instead. MacArthur's term as chief of staff expired in November, and the Morgan interests felt that if Roosevelt failed to reappoint him, he would be bitter enough to accept their offer. Butler observed that MacArthur would be likely to have difficulty in lining up veterans behind him because his dispersion of the Bonus Army had made him highly unpopular. The Bonus Army was, of course, the army of World War I soldiers who were not getting the pensions that they felt were due to them and marched to Washington en masse in a peaceful protest, and Douglas MacArthur took a bunch of troops out at the order of, I believe it was Coolidge, but I could be wrong. No, it was Hoover, and dispersed these unarmed American veterans who just wanted their pension benefits. McGuire, again the attorney, indicated that the Morgan coterie's second choice was Hanford McNider, an Iowa manufacturer who was a former commander of the American Legion. But McGuire emphasized that his own group was still insisting that Butler was the only military leader in the country capable of rallying the veterans behind him. The Morgan interests had acknowledged Butler's immense prestige and popularity, he revealed, but were apprehensive that as head of the paramilitary force, Butler might lead it in, quote, the wrong direction. Butler observed that McNider would have no more popular appeal than MacArthur, because he had gone on record as opposing the Bonus. McGuire then revealed that McNider would be cued to change his stand, and would do so. Butler remembered this prediction when, 3 weeks later, McNider suddenly reversed his position and came out in support of the Bonus. Okay, so inserting this quickly, McGuire is claiming to have this internal control and to know what's going on behind the scenes and letting Butler in on how well connected these men are and how good they are at manipulating things. They're saying Butler says McNider would not be a popular leader because of his opposition to this Bonus for World War I veterans who were all of them out of work because of the Depression. And McGuire tells him that's all right. McNider's going to reverse that position, presumably to make himself more popular in case he did wind up being the contingency leader of this coup d'etat. If Butler could not be persuaded to head the new superorganization, McGuire said, the offer would definitely be made to MacArthur, whether or not the latter was reappointed chief of staff. He confided that there would be an administration fight over MacArthur's reappointment, but he would get it, meaning MacArthur would get the appointment, because he was the son-in-law of Philadelphian Edward T. Stotesbury, a Morgan partner, Stotesbury, S-O-T-E-S-B-U-R-Y. It was a bold prediction, since never before in American history had a chief of staff been allowed to succeed himself. Butler was all the more startled and impressed with McGuire's sources of information when his prediction came true several months later.
I'd like to read you a little piece of information now from a book called 1,000 Americans. That was a book authored by a very famous anti-fascist writer named George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S. We've used his work before on this program. And 1,000 Americans by Seldes was published in hardcover by Bonnie and Gair, B-O-N-I and G-A-E-R, copyrighted 1947. Now, one of the last things in this book is a table which basically documents the amount of money contributed by various key American industrialists and financiers to various domestic American fascist organizations. And under the S section, we find under Stotesbury, E.T., recall the father-in-law of General Douglas MacArthur, a contribution of $1,000 to a fascist group called the Sentinels. That again from Radio Free America program number 10, recorded on July 11th, 1985. This concludes For the Record program number 448, The Coup Attempt of 1934, being recorded on March 7th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.